It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Riggert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at a preliminary settlement between the NFL and ex-players over concussion-related claims.
First, we're talking about the word sorry. A new Pantene Pro-V commercial focuses on women saying sorry in scenarios at work and at home, starting with the question, why do women apologize all the time?
The commercial then replays these situations without the apologies after advising women not to be sorry. We're not sure what this has to do with shampoo, but Pantene is right. Research shows that women apologize more than men do.
But our next guest says saying sorry doesn't always mean what you think it does. Deborah Tannen is a professor of linguistics at Georgetown University and the author of many best-selling books, including You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation. Deborah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, nice to be here.
So do women have a problem with saying I'm sorry too much?
Women do say I'm sorry more than men. This is a tendency. It's not every individual woman, of course. But whether or not it's a problem depends on the situation. In my own research, this came up both at work and at home. When a large project I did in a workplace where I shadowed people, tape recorded everything they said, interviewed the people, target people, their superiors, their subordinates, I did encounter situations where women said, I'm sorry, much more than men did, and sometimes were underestimated as a result because the feeling was, gee, she thinks everything's her fault, she lacks confidence, she should stop saying I'm sorry. However, there are many situations where, even at work, in one situation I encountered, if a woman didn't say I'm sorry, then she was seen as too abrasive. And so one woman told me she had to start saying I'm sorry. But the situation that interests me the most is when women say, I'm sorry, and it really is not an apology. You know, when if somebody suffers a loss and you say, oh, I'm so sorry, you're not pleading guilty to a murder charge. You're not saying it's my fault. You're saying, I'm sorry that happened. And often when women say, I'm sorry that happened, they say, I'm sorry, meaning I'm sorry that happened, they're really misinterpreted as, she thinks everything's her fault. She's apologizing. So that's one side of it. And you could simply say, if somebody says to you, don't apologize, it's not your fault, you could say, I wasn't apologizing. I was just saying I'm sorry it happened. So sometimes it's more effective to raise consciousness about the way you're using something rather than allowing other people to determine what it means and then deciding to change. So that's the work situation. Really interesting, when I wrote about women and men at home, and I have a book called I Only Say This Because I Love You, in which I have an entire chapter on apologies, a very large percentage of the frustrations that people told me about involved apologies. And I'll just give you a quick example. A couple that lived out in the country, she had asked him to mail letters. She emphasized how important it was. He said, of course, he'd be happy to mail it. And then the next day, they both got in the car, and there was a letter on the front seat. And he said, oh, I forgot to mail your letter. And she waited, and she was sure he was going to say, I'm sorry, and he didn't. They ended up having an argument, but it wasn't about the letter. It was about the apology. And her feeling was, what's such a big deal? You seem to think the earth is going to open up and swallow you if you just say, I'm sorry. He seemed to feel, what's the big deal? I committed a misdemeanor, but you want me to plead guilty to a felony. Of course I didn't do it on purpose. Of course I just forgot. And it did turn out, when I talked to many, many couples about this, that women and men often have very different approaches to apologies.
It sounds like there are culturally different connotations with the word sorry, that it's sort of a chameleon word. It can mean lots of different things in different situations.
It does. And referring to culture, I think, is very apt. You know, the British often say, oh, sorry, sorry, sorry. It's almost a stereotype. And it's kind of automatic, and we kind of use the way we might say, excuse me. But, yeah, I often use that metaphor that sometimes women and men are almost like different cultures in our assumptions about how to use language. And it seems that for many women, if you don't say you're sorry, it's like you don't care that you let her down. Saying I'm sorry just means I'm taking into account that this had some effect on you, and I regret that it had that effect, and I'm going to try not to do it again. It's a caring sign. And but for many men, it's a feeling that you're trying to kind of take advantage of having caught me in a lapse. And if I apologize, I'm putting myself in a weaker position. And in the future, you might use this against me. And all this is true. I mean, you hear this in politics. Never apologize, never explain, because yeah. It puts you in a weaker position.
So for men, saying sorry is kind of like gotcha. You know,
exactly.
You admit culpability, it's your fault, and you've got a black mark against you. For women, it sounds like more just a social exchange, an acknowledgement.
Right. And so much of language is automatic. We say things because we hear other people saying them, and we don't mean them literally. And so because so many women say I'm sorry so often, it becomes automatic. And we don't really mean it as an apology, although, you know, it's a really interesting thing, too, because everything we say because we expect a certain response. And often, and this, again, it's more common among women, men could do it, too, we might apologize as a way to get the other person to apologize. So if I know you did something wrong and you're not apologizing, I might apologize for my part, assuming you're going to say, and then I'm sorry for my part. And if you don't, it's even more frustrating.
Right.
I sometimes use the metaphor of a seesaw. You trust the other person to stay on, and if they get off, then you go flopping to the ground. But it isn't that you did something wrong. It's that they didn't do their part.
Right. It kind of it's like a call and response. Sorry needs
exactly.
Another story. Sorry, or it's just dangling out there. But I want to talk a little bit more about this Pantene commercial, because the implication in that commercial is that there is something wrong, that women are sort of handing away some of their power when they over-apologize, and especially if we know that it sounds like men are construing this to mean a sign of weakness. Is there an argument to be made that women should dial back the apologies at work?
There certainly is an argument to be made, especially in the workplace. And again, I don't think it's the only solution. You could try, as I said, raising consciousness about how you're using it. But any way of speaking, if you realize it's working against you, you might decide not to do it anymore. And I think of an example where I had observed a meeting, and there was a woman there who said, I'm sorry, 7 times in the meeting. And they were all automatic. None of them were apologies. Just a quick example, she was presenting something, she began to go back to her seat, and then, oh, I'm sorry, there was one more thing I was going to add, and went back to the front of the meeting. But while I was doing my research, she had received a very low rating, even though when I asked her peers and her immediate superiors and her subordinates, all of them, who's the best person in this group, they all named her. So something was going on that was preventing the higher-ups from seeing her true abilities. And I couldn't say there was a one-to-one connection, but I wouldn't be surprised if saying I'm sorry more often than anybody else, that's the key, by the way, that she's saying it more than others. If everybody was saying it, then she wouldn't come out looking bad. It's one among many things that you need to be aware of and consider talking differently if you think it's working against you.
Well, I will say I have been conscious about when I say sorry at work, because it does seem sometimes for women that it signals subservience or a lack of confidence, and it can read that way even if it's not intentional, even if it's the farthest thing from the truth. But it is really hard when you're used to it to get that word and that habit out of your workplace vocabulary.
Well, yeah, it's the language we use is automatic. If we had to stop and plan out every sentence, we'd all become aphasic. So, but that is a pattern that many of the ways of speaking that were common among women ended up making an impression, could make an impression of lack of confidence. And in fact, when anyone was not promoted or not hired, and I would always ask why in this research that I did, lack of confidence was a very common one, the most common reason given for women. And I think in many cases, it was a misinterpretation of ways of speaking. There are many others, too. You know about uptalk. We linguists call it rising intonation.
Right.
We end our sentences as if they were questions. That also can give an impression of uncertainty. Or we need to tell someone to do something, and we may say something like, could you do me a favor? And just starting that way, again, if you take it literally and you really think you're asking for a favor, then you're putting yourself in a one-down position. But more often than not, it's just a way that seems to us polite so that we're saving face for the other person. This is a very interesting pattern, by the way. Many of the styles of speaking that were common among women and were misinterpreted as lack of confidence were focused out ways of saving face for the other person. So a woman in a position of power often feels that the other people will have to do what they're asked because her powerful position requires it. So they don't want to rub the person's nose in it. We don't want to make them feel like they're subservient. And so it's a really interesting thing that women tended to use kind of indirectness and buffering, perhaps, would be a way to put it, requests that they made, were more likely to do it with subordinates than with superiors.
We're talking right now to linguist Deborah Tannen about the different meanings and uses of the word sorry.
And we're taking your calls next. Do you hear women apologizing more than men in your everyday life? How do you use the word sorry? And what do you mean when you say it? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, if you'd like to join in, 800-642-1234, or send us an email, talk@WPR.org.
We'll take your calls and pick up our conversation in a minute. Now a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jean Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with linguist Deborah Tannen about the many meanings and uses of the word sorry.
And we're taking your calls as well. What do you think about the use of the word sorry? How do you use it in your everyday conversation? Or have you scrubbed it from your vocabulary altogether? And if you're a man, how do you use the word sorry? Do you think less of a woman if she apologizes? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email, talk@WPR.org.
And Deborah, you mentioned earlier that one option, say, a woman would have was to try to raise consciousness around the word sorry and put it into context for people, especially if she feels it's being misinterpreted, saying, well, I'm not really saying I'm sorry. I'm just acknowledging that I'm sorry that this event happened. But does that really work? Can you really do it case by case? Or is it, you know, the better part of valor to just stop apologizing?
I think every person has to decide, given their own circumstances. If she feels that everything's going great at work, her position is completely stable, she feels appreciated, sure, why not? Go ahead and say, when somebody says, don't apologize, I wasn't apologizing. If you feel that you're not getting the recognition you deserve, then sure, you might think about changing that, as well as some of the other things that I mentioned. But I think we also want to not forget the situation at home, because that was one that created so much unhappiness in people's lives. And I was very intrigued. I started out with the assumption that wouldn't this be a better world if men would only learn to say, I'm sorry. So many of the fights that were reported to me were men refusing to apologize, women wanting the apology. And I was actually talking to a journalist one time, and I was mentioning how women sometimes, I never want to make any of this sound like it's everybody. There are many social and also cultural differences here. But I was saying there are many women who might not ask directly for something, but let you know what they want by indirectly mentioning it. And he said, oh, my wife does that all the time. I know what she wants, but I won't do it because I don't think she's telling me in the right way. And my thought was, what a jerk. But it was just at the time that I was writing this chapter on apologies. And it dawned on me, I'm one of these people who gets very frustrated with my husband if he won't say I'm sorry, even though I know he's sorry. In fact, now we have almost a joke between us. He'll say, I'm sorry for everything. So it's almost an apology, but not quite.
It's all-encompassing.
But it dawned on me that women's insistence that men say those words, I'm sorry, were no different than this journalist telling me he was wanted to insist on his wife asking him to do something in the way he thought was right. So I kind of think we could all learn to give other people maybe a bit more rope, a longer leash. Mm-hmm. And if we know somebody feels sorry, maybe not insist that they say it. But it would be equally easy, I think, for those who know that someone really, really just wants to hear those words to just try saying it. And, you know, the earth actually may not open up and swallow you.
Let's go to our phone lines now. We're going to take Lola first from Madison. Hi, Lola.
Hi. I found this conversation very interesting, and it piqued my interest because it's been a long-running issue for me, this overuse of the word I'm sorry. My boss would oftentimes overuse, he did overuse the word. He'd always say, I'm sorry. He would flip it, just run off his tongue. And it got to the point where it would just make me cringe when he would use the word, because it meant absolutely nothing to me. I didn't hear any sympathy or remorse from his air. It was just something that he casually used, overused, and it just used to make me cringe. And one day, I remember I decided I was going to really address this, and I said, well, what exactly are you sorry about? And he really, he paused and just stared at me, but I eventually lost my job. He didn't like me standing up to him.
Wow, so that's an interesting example. Lola finally says something about the overuse of sorry, and, you know, it backfires. So it is sort of a delicate territory, Deborah.
I love that example. It sounds like the biggest source of frustration was that he made errors, caused you inconvenience, and didn't really seem sorry. So maybe the problem was less that he was saying sorry, is that he wasn't acting like he was sorry. I sometimes say that to work, an apology needs four things. You need to seem apologetic. You need to acknowledge that you did something wrong. You need to acknowledge the effect that it had on the other person. And you need to say you're not going to do it again, or do something to make up for it. And it sounds like he didn't do any of those things, but was just saying the word sorry. And maybe that was the source why it was so maddening.
Well, Lola, thanks a lot for sharing your story, and we'll go next to Linda joining us in Madison. Hi, Linda.
Hi, can you hear me?
Uh-huh, you're fine.
Okay, well, I kind of, coming from the opposite spectrum, where the need of the term used, I'm sorry, is brought up in the medical profession, where I was surrounded for a number of years, and it's just more recently come to light that especially physicians in the position that they are in have the ability and can, without repercussion, say the words, I'm sorry, within their duties of care. And it may come up even in the case of mistakes that are made, but also, you know, in just as far as bedside manner, a better approach, and being that they are human.
And Linda, do you think that's an improvement?
Oh, by all means, yes.
Yeah, that's such an important point to make, and I actually have written about this in actually more than one book. There is absolute research that supporting what you're saying, that that patients will sue often just to get the physician to apologize. And insurance companies traditionally told doctors, never apologize, because that's admitting fault and you'll get sued. And the truth is the opposite. When the physician apologizes, the patient is far less likely to sue. And I think this is even relevant to the point you were making early, Veronica, that I'm so hesitant to say, let's tell women to stop apologizing and this will be a better world. Maybe it will be a better world if everybody apologized more when they really have done something wrong. And that example from medicine is such a crucial one. And it really shows how important it is to people to feel that someone who has done in some way caused them harm feels bad about it. And that's what I think is so important about the physicians apologizing.
Well, Deborah, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
We've been speaking with Deborah Tannen, professor of linguistics at Georgetown University and the author of many best-selling books, including You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Bricker.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out why hookah use is on the rise among high school students and whether or not that is cause for concern.
First, yesterday a federal judge cleared the way for a settlement between the National Football League and more than 4,500 retired NFL players over concussion-related claims.
Now, this preliminary settlement comes after months of legal wrangling by both sides, and it would provide compensation for players who are dealing with brain-related injuries or injuries that could develop later in life. The new settlement marks the first legal change in how the NFL addresses its ailing retirees, some of whom have been very critical about how the league has treated them after their playing days.
Here with us now to talk about the proposed settlement and what's next for the two sides is Ken Belson, sports reporter at the New York Times. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with this proposed settlement. What did this judge decide?
Well, the proposed settlement was technically proposed almost a year ago, and the original proposal had a cap on monetary awards of $675 million. The judge in January said that she thought that might not be enough to cover the 65-year length of the settlement, so she left it at that, and they came back with a new proposed settlement, which she has since approved, which includes no cap on damages. That's the headline number, so to speak.
So this includes damages. What else is perhaps going to be included in this package deal?
The players will also get something called baseline testing, covers, how can I say, preliminary tests that they can then use to compare if the players deteriorate. So they'll know their cognitive state when they're 35, and they'll be able to compare that to something when, say, they develop mild dementia or more serious dementia.
And let's get a little background on this. Can we talk about how this case got started and how we got to today?
It's somewhat unusual in class action terms. It started out as a set of small one-off lawsuits filed around the country in state and federal court by players and different sets of lawyers. And for ease of administration, they were put under something called multi-district litigation, or MDL, and consolidated in Philadelphia in federal court. And the first big test was last April, when the league essentially had the judge had a hearing where the league argued that all of these cases should be thrown out because they should be covered under the labor laws governing the NFL and the labor agreements with the union. The judge never ruled on that, which is a key threshold in a lot of these kind of sports labor cases, because the two sides decided to settle instead. And the lawyers for the players argue that that actually is a good thing because they might actually lose the first argument about whether it should be covered under labor law and might get zero. So at least by settling, they get something rather than potentially nothing. That was back, the arguments were in April, and then we led to the settlement, which was first announced in August last year.
So the cap on the damages has been removed. Is there any sort of ballpark figure about what kind of money we're looking at here from the NFL?
Well, the NFL basically says that they believe that their actuaries and economists tell them that the first number, the $675 million, is still essentially accurate, but they want to relieve any anxiety about whether the number will be accurate, and therefore they remove the cap. So they don't think the number is going to be a lot more than what they've already published. There are many others who say it's not so much the dollar figure, it's the terms of qualifying for the dollars. So in other words, what kind of illnesses do you need to get or have to get any money? And some players argue that They've only included a narrow set of categories, for example, Parkinson's disease, ALS, severe dementia, and of course, football players get many other kinds of issues that are outside of those broad categories. And so, yes, there's 760 or 675 million set aside, but they're saying it's not going to cover the mass number of players and their injuries.
Now, this is being hailed as a landmark deal. How significant is it when it comes to the culpability of the NFL when it comes to concussions?
Well, as part of the settlement, the NFL admits no fault, so we'll never know, at least in this context, what they knew about concussions and what they did or didn't share with the retired players over the last 20-some-odd years. So we're not going to get any more insight into that. And then players who sign on to the settlement, assuming it's approved, it'll be majority of retired players, give up their rights to sue the NFL on this issue in the future. So, and this is not uncommon in a lot of class action cases. It sort of gives the league immunity from future cases. And so it's a landmark case insofar as the NFL has put up a ton of money potentially to pay for medical costs, but it's probably not going to shed a heck of a lot more light on what they knew and when.
Does this, though, signal that going forward the NFL is going to have to be a lot more careful about its policies regarding concussions?
Yes, and I think they probably already have been. But the bulk of the accusations stem from the 90s. And I think really the turning point from the NFL's perspective, to answer your question specifically, came sort of in 2009 when Roger Goodell, the commissioner, was asked to testify in front of Congress about concussions. I think that was their real big wake-up call. And you could argue that everything they've done since then, putting sideline extra neurologists on the sideline, having an extra set of eyes in the press box, identifying players who may have been concussed during a game, leaving the game protocol and coming back to play that protocol. All those things, I think, have come since 2009 and helped mitigate some of these problems. I don't know whether the injury figures fully tell the story, but I think the league has certainly been chastened by being hauled in front of Congress and, frankly, all of these lawsuits. I mean, it's a very damaging sight when your retirees are suing the league, not for some intellectual property argument or please share some money from video games with me, but basically accusing the league of neglecting them. And that could be a very damaging thing if this had gone to court or gone to trial.
What kind of reaction is this getting from the players who are involved?
It's a good question. You've got a universe of 20,000 players. Obviously, you've got 20,000 opinions. And I think in large part, and this is based mostly just on my anecdotal conversations with various retirees, is it breaks down partly generationally. I think older players see the league now as a very wealthy league, and they see their own role in that as diminished. In other words, they'll say, well, you know, when I played, I only had $2,000 a year pension benefit, or I made $15,000 a year and I was happy to get it. And now they see players with multi-million-dollar contracts. And whether it's out of jealousy or spite, I think they see the younger generation of players as getting off easy. And as a consequence, I think some of these older players are quite angry at the NFL. But really, it boils down to where they are health-wise. And I think anybody with serious injuries now is probably more willing to take the money now because they could use the money now, whereas a player who may be reasonably healthy and doesn't necessarily foresee themselves getting dementia may want to hold out for more in the future.
This isn't quite a done deal yet, but do you expect this to go through?
Good question. This is a approval of a preliminary settlement. The packets will be sent out to roughly 20,000 players. My sense is it will be approved by the players. The reason for that is somewhat technical in that in class action suits like this, the players don't literally have to vote yes. If they do nothing, they will be deemed to be in agreement with the settlement. And so there's a fairly high bar to get enough votes against the settlement to persuade the judge to not approve it. And so for that reason, I think it'll probably get approved. And I think also when the papers are in front of people and they finally see the numbers and they see that this is most of the way to the finish line, they may just say, you know what? What the heck? I'm just going to sign on. The other serious word of caution, which I'm sure any good lawyer will discuss with their client, is if you're going to opt out and preserve your legal rights to sue the NFL, what's that going to cost? There's no guarantee you'll get a penny. You're going to be taking on the NFL by yourself, and that could be a very expensive proposition. So for that reason, too, I think a lot of players are going to say, you know what, throw up their arms and let me just take what I could get.
Ken, thank you so much for being here today.
Sure, my pleasure.
We've been talking to Ken Belson, sports reporter at The New York Times. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. After decades of anti-smoking public health campaigns, cigarette smoking among teens and young adults has dropped significantly. In fact, the Centers for Disease Control announced last month that cigarette smoking among U.S. high school students was at its lowest level in 25 years. But that doesn't mean that all tobacco use among teens has slowed down.
A new report out this week finds that about one in five high school students have tried smoking tobacco from a hookah, which has caught on in recent years, and teens of higher socioeconomic status were more likely to be hookah smokers. So the question, should we be concerned?
Joining us now to discuss this is Dr. Michael Weitzman, co-author of the study and professor of pediatrics, environmental medicine, and public health at the NYU Langone School of Medicine. Dr. Weitzman, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, I want to start out with a very basic question, first of all. For people who might not know what a hookah is, what is it?
Well, it's called a water pipe. I think many people, if they saw one, would know what it is. They've been around the United States for quite some time, but they've been around the Middle East for centuries. They are large glass bowls of varying size and beauty on which tobacco is placed on top and heated by charcoal. And then the smoker sucks in through a tube that's attached to this. And the smoke comes into this bowl and then is filtered through water and then goes up into the person's mouth and lungs.
Yeah, so when I think of hookahs, I think of old movies set in the Mideast, or I think of hipster hookah bars in large urban areas. And the study, though, indicates that lots of teens are actually taking up smoking hookahs. Tell me about the numbers. What do they look like?
Well, the numbers are really quite terrifying. So it's about one in five high school students has used a hookah, and it's about one in 20 who's used one in the past month. Now, we've been profoundly successful in reducing cigarette smoking in the United States. There's been about a 35% decline just in the past 10 years. There's been a 135% increase in use of hookahs and things like e-cigarettes over the same time period. What's really most concerning is that there's this misconception that hookahs are safer than cigarettes, whereas what data exists suggests that they're as dangerous or possibly far more dangerous than smoking cigarettes.
Let's talk about that misconception first. Why is it that people might think that smoking a hookah is safer?
Well, the first thing is that anybody can go on a website and simply type in water pipe or hookah and come up with all sorts of advertisements that are aimed at adolescents and young people. And they're advertised as a safer alternative to tobacco, to cigarettes, rather. And they're described as a wonderful way to relax in a social setting with friends. And so you have targeting at youth. And we have not paid a lot of attention until the past 2 or 3 years to the emergence of these alternative tobacco products, which started with the changes in migration patterns to the United States, but have now been taken up by adolescents and young people. So it's intriguing to me that you mentioned hipster neighborhoods, because these data are the first data to show that it's wealthier and more educated kids who are more likely to be using this. So in the past, it's been poor people, and immigrants and poor and people with mental health problems who have smoked cigarettes. This is likely, if it's not stopped, to be the first generation where we're going to lose 20 to 30 years of life expectancy for huge numbers of middle class and upper class people. So it's really, from a societal point of view, as well as a public health point of view, it's an epidemic deserving of profound attention.
Yeah, that's interesting because, as I say, when I think of hookahs, I think of their size and sort of the location, that aspect of them, where they're not very handy. You know, you have to go somewhere. You don't really carry them around with you, although there are these things, I understand, the pen hookahs or the hookah pens right now. But it seems like that would limit it somehow. But you're telling me that it's not so, that people are going out of their way to congregate, and it's more of a social thing to do than smoking alone.
Well, you're asking a number of remarkable questions that get at the problem. So the attention to date, which is becoming very frenetic amongst the public health community, which is very terrified, is about hookah bars. All right? But all around urban settings, and I would imagine in many settings in Wisconsin as well, are emerging tobacconists that advertise that they sell hookahs and shisha. And so they're all over, for example, New York. I'm talking about hundreds of these places. So people are purchasing these, and they must be using them at home. But there's no data on that. Everybody focuses on the hookah bars. And they do tend to cluster, both in New York and the other communities that we've looked at, in communities with younger people, what we used to call counterculture. You used the term hipster. And around universities. Now, one of the things that everybody should know is that many people share a hookah. So you and I and other people, if I were with you right now, could be sharing the same hookah at the same time. So we'd be blowing into this thing and breathing in, and we'd be exchanging bacteria. In the developing world, it's been shown to be a very effective way to transmit tuberculosis. So infectious diseases are going to be transmitted, as well as profoundly dangerous levels of carcinogens, things that ultimately result in cancer. But this is a relatively new field of research. In large part, it's being propelled because the Federal Drug Administration can only regulate tobacco products, and many of the hookah bars claim that they use something called shisha, which is herbal and doesn't contain tobacco. We have finished other studies that show that that's not true, that every hookah bar we've been in New York, they use tobacco. So providing that sort of information, as well as research on the untoward effects on health, are desperately needed to help propel legislation. But the public needs to know that despite the appearance of this being a cool thing to do, there are some studies that suggest that an hour using a hookah, which is about the time of an average hookah session, may be the equivalent of 5 packs of cigarettes.
1 hour?
So it's possible. That's what some studies show. And, you know, if you go to a hookah bar, you pay for 45 minutes to an hour of doing this. So if you're going to spend the evening there, Who's ever smoked 5 to 15 packs of cigarettes? So you're talking about middle class and upper class kids, because this is expensive, destroying their lungs, destroying their hearts. Now, that's speculation, because nobody has the data long term. But acutely, we've looked, and you can measure in the blood acute inflammatory responses. So your whole body is responding. It's not just your lungs and your heart, but you can measure things in the blood that white blood cells produce when they are challenged and threatened. So this is a very dangerous epidemic that's largely been invisible, but I can assure you it will not be invisible for a long time.
So yeah, I wanted to ask, you mentioned data collection there. I imagine data collection is continuing, but you also mentioned legislation. What types of legislation, regulation, do you think people ought to be talking about that we ought to be looking at?
Well, many places in the United States have Clean Air Acts where you're not allowed to smoke cigarettes in public places, in restaurants, in bars, in parks. The thing, so that's been very effective, but the thing that's worked the best has been public education and taxation. So right now there's no taxing going on of this shisha, the tobacco that's smoked, and there's no taxing of the places that are selling these. So there's a whole array of legislation that you could do. You could stop sales to youngsters. You could stop advertising on the web or in teenage magazines, just like we did with cigarettes. There are a host of things that have proven profoundly, profoundly effective with cigarettes.
And I'm afraid that's where we're going to have to leave it, Dr. Weitzman. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us.
My honor. Thank you so much. Bye.
Dr. Michael Weitzman is a professor of pediatrics, environmental medicine, and public health at the NYU Langone School of Medicine.